From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis, plus some analysis of what's going on. Anti-nuclear protest in Taiwan. A permanent museum to remember the Tiananmen crackdown of 1989. Also ahead, two former popes made saints. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A group of European monitors detained by pro-Russian insurgents in eastern Ukraine appeared in public on Sunday to give assurances they are not being mistreated, even as negotiations began to secure their release. With armed rebels watching as they spoke, the leaders of the monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, German Colonel Axel Schneider, assured reporters in Sloviansk they were in good health. The insurgents call the 80 military observers prisoners of war. Schneider says they're being held for political reasons.
Our presence here in Sloviansk is for sure a political instrument for the decision makers here in the region. And the possibility to use it for negotiations.
Meantime, at a news conference in Malaysia, President Obama warned economic sanctions against Russia will be stiffened because he said Moscow is encouraging unrest in the largely Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine.
There's strong evidence that they've been encouraging the kinds of activities that have been taking place in eastern and southern Ukraine. And so collectively, us and the Europeans have said that so long as Russia continues down the path of provocation rather than trying to resolve this issue peacefully and de-escalating, there are going to be consequences, and those consequences will continue to grow.
And here in Washington, a national security official said new sanctions this week will target Russia's defense industry and companies with close links to Russian President Vladimir Putin. In a joint statement late Friday, the group of seven major economies announced it had agreed to move swiftly on new sanctions against Russia because of its interference in Ukraine. President Obama says the United States and Europe must act together in levying sanctions against Russia over its actions in Ukraine that he says threaten the country's independence and sovereignty. Well, for some analysis of the Ukraine crisis, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with two scholars. Ariel Cohen is a senior research fellow in Russian and Eurasian studies at the International Energy Policy at the Heritage Foundation, plus William Pomerantz, deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies, the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Cohen said the current Ukrainian crisis is, in his opinion, the most serious security concern so far of the 21st century.
It has at least two components I can see. One is the regional component, its relationship between Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine, of course, was partitioned and occupied by Russia and Poland and Turkey, even before the partitions of Poland. And Russia today is reverting to the rhetoric that we did not see since the Tsarist times, denying the Ukrainians peoplehood, national identity, statehood, and language. One of the top Russian propagandists, Margarita Simonyan, the head of RT TV channel, tweeted, "Ukraine, RIP, rest in peace." This is nothing short of, I would say, near genocidal intent. When you deny a country its right to exist, it is very, very severe. It violates the UN Charter, and it raises very deep questions about security in Europe. But beyond that, the second part of this problem is what Russia is doing, bringing back ethnicity and culture as the base of foreign policy and not citizenship and established borders. This has implications because everyone has co-ethnics living across the border, and the darkest era of the 20th century, of late 1930s and 40s, was cloaked in the protection of co-ethnics in Central Europe, in Austria with the Anschluss, and in Sudetenland with the reunification of the German-speaking people. And finally, This is the question about the post-World War II global order that for decades was based on American power. During the Cold War, the balance between the U.S. and the USSR, and after the end of the Cold War, it for a while looked like the triumph of liberal democracy. Some people even wrote books about the end of history. And as I quipped at that time, history did not end, neither did geography. Geography dictates what's going on around the world, including in Ukraine right now. And this is a very serious challenge to the Obama administration after setbacks in the Middle East, in East Asia, and now in Europe.
Turning to you, William Pomerantz, certainly regional problems, insinuating that Ukraine perhaps shouldn't exist, RIP, rest in peace. We are going backwards, it seems. In addition to that, we have this whole challenge to the global world order, post-World War II order. How do you see the situation to date?
Well, Ariel is right that Russia has made this decision to deny notions of Ukrainian statehood and ethnicity. And it was very revealing when Putin pulled up his map of sometime during Catherine the Great's reign and pointed to New Russia, which of course denies all the things that occurred in Ukraine, or what was Ukraine, during the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. It was really a very blatant statement. And Ariel is right as well. The notion of Ukraine was always denied throughout the Tsarist period. There were massive restrictions on the use of Ukrainian language, Ukrainian culture. And the fact that somehow Putin has decided to retreat back to 18th century thinking is, of course, very dangerous in terms of the 21st century that we live in.
Okay, so we all agree it's very dangerous and escalating by the minute. So, Ariel Cohen, one more look back at history, as if we could really change things, but it's important to put things in context. In retrospect, did the United States, did the European Union make some mistakes, perhaps, about expanding NATO and the EU into the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries? This does not justify in any way Putin's belligerent actions, but he talks about this sphere of influence in addition to ethnic groups and protecting ethnic minorities, Russian-speaking minorities. To what extent do you think the West is paying for what some say maybe were overzealous overtures to the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries?
What you described is an opinion. It's a minority opinion that prevails in Washington in what I would call the ultra-realist school. The people who could be identified maybe with the Nixon administration and with the Bush senior administration. There are some people like that. You hear this opinion that we should not have expanded NATO. I must say that both Republicans and Democrats in Clinton and Bush II administrations, so four administrations, were staunch supporters of Europe whole and free, of expanding NATO and the European Union. And if eventually the United States, the EU, and Japan end up in a free trade zone, together with Mexico and Canada, of course, this would be a tremendous achievement for freedom, for economic freedom, for the rule of law. So I am not an opponent of expansion of NATO. I think there may have been a tenuous opportunity to reach out to the Russians more and drag the Russians in inviting and pulling Russia into that center of gravity, including things like free travel to Europe, etc. Today, unfortunately, we pass that point. Mr. Putin believes that Russia can be a pole in the multipolar world. Whatever that is, what I think it really means to translate is that Russia will be a raw material appendage, not to the West, but to China. And if the Russians think that this is a preferable geopolitical outcome, so be it. But I would say if you have to apportion the responsibility here, it is the policy of reset with Russia that was, from the get-go, mistranslated.
Ariel Cohen is a senior research fellow in Russian and Eurasian Studies and International Energy Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He and William Pomerantz, deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, spoke with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear their entire conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and look for Encounter under the Programs tab.
Each week, week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist, and she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
Thousands of anti-nuclear protesters marched through Taiwan's capital Taipei on Sunday, calling on the government to stop the construction of a fourth nuclear power plant in the country. Protesters chanted as they marched to the city's main shopping district, where they blocked traffic and occupied the main street. Many of them worried that a fourth nuclear power plant in the country could increase the likelihood of a nuclear crisis. One of the protesters in Taipei, R.B. Wong, said that they don't want Taiwan to turn into another nuclear crisis like that happened at Fukushima in Japan in 2011. A barrier with barbed wire and yellow tape separated the protesters from the presidential office, where President Ma Ying-jeou met with opposition leaders who are against the plant. Although Mr. Ma said a referendum will be held once the power plant and safety inspections are completed, the government says halting the project could lead to electricity shortages. The new power plant is being built next to the ocean, about 60 kilometers away from the capital. But protesters say that being built in the part of the country where earthquakes are frequent, leading to fears that the fourth power plant could be vulnerable in the future. A permanent museum to remember the Tiananmen crackdown of 1989 has officially opened in Hong Kong. Observers say that 25 years after the event, Chinese people need to know more about what happened and called on Beijing to face its troubled history. Rebecca Valley reporting now from Hong Kong.
The exhibition is the world's first museum dedicated to the brutal crackdown ordered by the Chinese leadership 25 years ago. While references to the crackdown are banned on the mainland, activists and politicians in Hong Kong have long called on Beijing to offer a full account of what happened on June 4, 1989. Li Zhuoren, chairman of the Hong Kong Alliance in Support of Patriotic Democratic Movements of China, is one of the organizers. He says the media blackout has left younger generations in the dark. He says they're very confused about what happened in Tiananmen. They should come to the museum to learn more about June 4th, so they can carry that knowledge and the spirit of the students' movement back to China and strive for democracy. The museum takes up less than 75 square meters on the fifth floor of an office building in the Tsim Sha Tsui tourist district. It is organized as a maze with pictures and written accounts of the events leading up to the crackdown, when the government ordered the People's Liberation Army to shoot at protesters. In 1989, Chen Qinghua was a representative sent by the Hong Kong Student Association to support the student movement, which had been demonstrating for months against corruption and calling for political reform. He says that in the late evening of June 3rd, he was at a medical station near Tiananmen Square, and what he saw filled him with disbelief and anger.
Starting from like 10:30, 11 o'clock, people bore gun wounds. Some of them are dead on arrival. We are so shocked on that. You never prepare for that.
An official death toll has never been made public, and estimates range from hundreds to thousands of dead. The government in China says the protests were counter-revolutionary and insists that China has moved on from that political turmoil. The last 30 years of development, Beijing says, show that the country has reached a clear conclusion on those events. Liu Reishao is an Hong Kong journalist. He was in Beijing during the crackdown and says that economic development alone will not make China strong. He says that June 4th is a wound for all the Chinese people. If we do not absorb the lessons from what happened, he says, the efforts for a prosperous and enlightened nation will all be useless. The museum, which opened Saturday, ran into some opposition. The building's owners' committee tried to block the opening with a vote earlier this month, an effort that organizers say was due to pressure from mainland authorities. On Saturday, pro-Beijing protesters stood outside the museum's building, holding banners suggesting violence was started by the student movement. Rebecca Valli reporting for VOA News, Hong Kong.
New York City's Sherpa community continues to mourn the 16 mountain guides killed by an avalanche on Mount Everest. That avalanche swept away on April 18th while the group was preparing to route that is to be used in the coming weeks by Western climbers. VOA's Adam Phillips reporting now from New York, home to the largest community of Sherpas outside of Nepal.
It's the end of the week, and many of the estimated 3,500 Sherpa residents of Elmhurst, Queens, are still at work. So too in the colorful Buddhist temple at the United Sherpa Association headquarters, where a Sherpa monk is busy washing ritual brass lamps to prepare for a community-wide memorial service on Sunday. Nepalese American Angeljan Sherpa leads the organization.
New York is a busy life. But yet we keep in touch with our community back home. And we are all connected through emails or through phones. So people knew these people and most of them were brought up there around the Everest region. So definitely, the feeling was more sorrow.
Angeljan Sherpa is proud of his people's tradition of safely guiding intrepid mountaineers, usually from the West, up Mount Everest, which is scaled in ever more treacherous stages up to its nearly 9,000-meter high summit.
And the climbers who go up the mountain, they know that the risk factor is there. Every year people get killed on the mountain. Still, they're willing to take these risks because they have to put food on the table. Of course, the safety concern is very important. But you can't do nothing about the avalanches.
One can, however, do safer work, even if it is far less lucrative than guiding groups up the mountain and carrying their gear. That's what Pasang Kanchi Sherpa told her brother before he died in the accident, many years after her other brother met the same fate. She spoke to VOA by phone.
Every week I talk on the phone, but I tend not to go mountain. I'm so worried about his, but I don't know, he's not listening to me. Now I have no brothers. I'm very heartbroken, my brother. He was so kind, careful, and always happy person. I love my brother. I miss him.
Nyawang Dondup, a Buddhist monk, saw Pasang Kanchi Sherpa weeping constantly during the 8-hour traditional funeral ceremony for her brother. The monk had both an emotional reaction and a spiritual explanation.
It's really sad that it happened there. But people have to die. It's because of their karma. According to Buddhism, that when people die, they will burn again in a good place. So you just have to pray for them.
United Sherpa Association President Angeljan Sherpa says it wasn't only karma that brought death to those Sherpas on the mountain. It was economic necessity and few other options.
That's why, we are in America. We have to tell our kids. We have to focus on education. We have to break the cycle of, climbing.
Angeljan Sherpa says he hopes his people will learn to strike a balance between the proud traditions of the past and present-day safety concerns on the world's highest peak, where the number of adventure-seeking Western tourists grows every year. Meanwhile, Sherpas everywhere continue to grieve. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
World Health Organization is urging adults to get their children immunized against deadly and debilitating diseases and to make sure their own immunizations are up to date. The WHO observing World Immunization Week through April the 30th. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on the safety of vaccines and a controversy about them.
The international push to eliminate polio has put this disease on the verge of eradication worldwide. When that happens, no one will ever suffer paralysis or death from polio again. India is the latest country to become polio-free. The Gavi Alliance is one of the organizations that gets vaccines to children in developing countries. Dr. Seth Berkley is Gavi's chief executive officer.
Since we started, we've immunized more than 440 million additional children and have prevented more than 6 million deaths. The challenges that sit in front of us are that there are still about 22 million children that are not fully immunized.
The World Health Organization reports that immunization prevents 2 to 3 million deaths per year from childhood diseases and two types of cancer. This year, the WHO is encouraging people to make sure their families' immunizations are up to date. And while most parents in developing countries want their children immunized, a growing number of parents in Western countries are choosing not to. Steve and Victoria Carrico are among them.
We told them no vaccinations right off the bat.
Like most parents who choose not to vaccinate their children, the Caricos say they are concerned about possible side effects. At the U.S. National Institutes of Health, Dr. Anthony Fauci says in developed countries, the success of vaccines has been their downfall.
Years and years ago, when there were many children throughout the world, developed countries and developing nations, getting ill and dying or being maimed from diseases like polio, measles, mumps, rubella, hemophilus, vaccinations were so successful in decreasing the burden of disease that people now, when they think about vaccination, they think about the very rare event of a possible adverse event from a vaccine and shy away from vaccines, thinking that vaccines are the problem, when in fact vaccines are preventing us from getting very serious illness.
Dr. Berkley says money spent on vaccines means less money is needed to treat disease and disability.
Vaccines are, among the most effective and cost-effective interventions that exist.
Dr. Berkley says some parents worry that a vaccine might be damaged if it's not properly refrigerated. He says such a situation might make the vaccine ineffective, but it is not likely to make it harmful. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Pope Francis, leader of the Roman Catholic Church, has proclaimed two of his predecessors, John the 23rd and John Paul II, as saints at a ceremony Sunday in St. Peter's Square.
Ioannem vicesimum tertium et Ioannem Paulum secundum sanctos esse decernimus et definimus ac sanctorum catalogo adscribimus statuentes eos in universa ecclesia inter santos pia devotionis recoli debere in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
That was the Pope speaking in Latin in St. Peter's. Officials are saying as many as 1 million people crowded St. Peter's and the nearby streets of Rome for the elevation of the two former popes to sainthood. It is the first time that two popes have been elevated to sainthood at the same time. Relics of the two new saints were brought to the altar before the ceremony. John Paul's blood used in the 2011 beatification and a small piece of John's skin taken after his body was exhumed for a 2000 beatification. Relics are used to help the faithful venerate. The newly canonized popes are widely seen as representing contrasting factions of the Roman Catholic Church. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today here on the Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, the latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers Aiden Utku and Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On April 28, 1758, James Monroe, the fifth U.S. president, was born. Monroe is best known for the doctrine that bears his name. It discouraged European interference in the Western Hemisphere, seeking to avoid any attempts to make the New World a battleground for Old World nations. On April 28, 1881, U.S. outlaw and folk hero William H. Bonney, better known as Billy the Kid, escaped from a courthouse jail in New Mexico. The Kid had been awaiting execution, having been found guilty of murder. 3 months later, the icon of the American Wild West was shot and killed by a sheriff. In 1908, ethnic German businessman Oskar Schindler was born in what is now the Czech Republic. Schindler saved the lives of hundreds of his Jewish factory workers during World War II. His efforts are recounted in the book and movie Schindler's List. In 1937, Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was born, leading his country into two devastating wars. Saddam's nearly 25-year rule was characterized by brutal suppression of internal dissent. He was overthrown in the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. He was captured later that year, tried, and later executed. In 1945, Italian communist partisans executed former dictator Benito Mussolini and his mistress as the fascist leader attempted to flee to Switzerland near the close of World War II. On this day in 1969, Charles de Gaulle resigned as president of France after his proposals for constitutional reform were defeated in a national referendum. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 28th, in the United States, in Israel, and in many places around the world, we observe Yom HaShoah, which means Day of Remembrance of the Holocaust. In ceremonies across the globe, observers read from the Book of Names and light six candles in honor of the 6 million Jews who perished. Holocaust survivors engage with their communities and share their personal stories. The Holocaust was the greatest crime in human history. 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazi regime and its collaborators solely because they were Jewish. It began in the 1930s when the Nazi Party came to power and the German government began to target those they deemed to be inherently inferior. Such people, mostly civilians, were rounded up, shut into ghettos, and deported to dozens of concentration or slave labor camps. Some were shot and dumped into mass graves. By 1941, a number of camps were being run specifically for mass killing. Those sent to slave labor camps were slowly starved or worked to death. In addition to Jews, the Nazis targeted a number of other groups, including Roma, the disabled, homosexuals, and the Slavic peoples, because of their perceived inferiority. Some were persecuted on political or ideological grounds, among them communists, socialists, Jehovah's Witnesses, Freemasons, and anyone who resisted the Nazi dictatorship. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the international community resolved never again to allow such atrocities to occur. In 1948, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. In 1979, the United States Congress established the Day of Remembrance and later the Holocaust Memorial Museum to keep the memory of the victims alive for future generations. Today, this museum has its own center for genocide prevention. The legacy of Holocaust victims enriches our understanding and is a symbol of the meaning of human dignity. In America, survivors remind us of the importance of tolerance by speaking in classrooms and community institutions across the country. They serve as living history, sharing their stories and recounting the experiences of all who perished. Poet Claire Guest writes, "We couldn't stop the horror. We couldn't stop the hate. We can't change history. We are here too late. But what we can do is remember in our thoughts and in our ways. Let these memories guide our actions."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.